International Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
My name is Andy Hill. I'm a Senior Director in ICMA's Market Practice and Regulatory Policy team. I'd like to discuss the report that ICMA published at the end of May on how the European investment grade corporate bond secondary market performed during the COVID-19 crisis. The market moves and dislocations experienced during the onset of the recent global COVID-19 pandemic are unprecedented in recent times and arguably surpassed those seen during the global financial crisis of 2007-09. The report documents how the European investment grade corporate bond secondary market performed during the last weeks of February through March and April 2020. Drawing on interviews and surveys of sell side and buy side market participants, as well as market data and analysis, it attempts to identify the key themes and dynamics of the COVID-19 crisis, the challenges faced by market participants, and the extent to which the market was able to adapt and respond. The report also looks to provide some potential lessons learnt from the recent turbulence. The report focuses on a number of key topics and themes. These include market liquidity, the market moves during the crisis, how market structure held up, the impacts of central bank intervention, the influence of new issuance on secondary moves and liquidity, the corporate bond ETF market, credit default swap market, both single name and index, the importance of the credit repo market, the occurrence and impacts of an increase in settlement fails, the challenges of trading under lockdown, and finally, potential lessons learned. For this podcast, I'd like to just focus on some of those themes: market liquidity during this time, market structure and how that held up, the impact and significance of settlement fails, and finally, to recap on some of the potential lessons learned. Firstly, market liquidity. The surveys and interviews provide a consistent and compelling view that liquidity in the European IG credit market became severely impaired during the period of late February and early to mid-March. And that while conditions have improved since, at least by early May, they had not yet returned to their pre-crisis levels. Furthermore, while the general decline in liquidity seems to have applied across all asset classes, it appears to have been driven by a number of contributing factors and dynamics, impacting different market segments and trading flows as the crisis evolved. Many contributors remark on both the speed and scale of the change in market sentiment as being a major consideration. Respondents report that as the scale of the COVID-19 pandemic became clearer toward the end of February, and as countries began to go into lockdown, so predominantly passive funds en masse became sellers of risk assets, partly as they began to reassess the risk associated with certain credits, including the potential for downgrades, but also in anticipation of fund outflows. Sell sides report a buy-to-sell inquiry skew going into early March as high as 20-80 to even 10-9, noting that in previous corrections during this multi-year rally, this would not rise much above 40-60. The greater this skew in either direction, and the quicker it happens, the more pressure this puts on market makers' balance sheets, both in terms of their capacity to warehouse risk and their ability to recycle it. As we move further into March, and as the sell-off gained momentum, so market participants increasingly relocated and physically separated their trading and support staff, either moving to various disaster recovery sites or working from home. With this came initial technical challenges, the extent and duration of which seemed to vary across individual firms, but which undoubtedly put more strains, at least initially, on performing everyday trading functions. This too seems to have exacerbated the erosion of market efficiency and liquidity. By March 18, considered to be the nadir of liquidity crisis, some buy sides report that the market had become dysfunctional. The ECB's seismic intervention with the announcement of the PEP, the Pandemic Emergency Purchase Program, along with related initiatives to support the market, seem to have been both timely and pivotal in providing much needed confidence. The intensity of the ensuing snapback in credit spreads was felt to be even greater than that of the preceding sell-off. Some buy-sides report that liquidity in the week following March 18 was perhaps even worse than the week leading into it. Sell-sides similarly report that the buy-to-sell inquiry skew fully reversed to close to 90-10, as asset managers came back into the market looking to redeploy funds and rebalance risk. Once again, market maker capacity appears to have become stretched in the face of predominantly one-directional flow. By the end of March and early April, a slew of new issuance would seem to have helped to meet investor demand, as well as to anchor pricing. While fund inflows and outflows also began to stabilize. While respondents report that liquidity conditions were still some way off from pre-crisis levels, they were nonetheless much improved, and the market had begun to take on a sense of near normality. While bid-offer spreads in dealer-based markets are primarily a function of underlying market volatility, they are also influenced by a number of other factors, including dealer balance sheet cost and capacity, hedging accessibility and costs, funding costs, and the expected time to recycle risk. Variables that are also intrinsic to measures of market liquidity. A notable observation over this period is that bid-offer spreads widen significantly. Ordinarily, bid-offer spreads also tend to be influenced by trade size, particularly in less liquid markets. However, it would seem that dealer spreads widen generically, including for smaller transaction sizes. Furthermore, while these are not as extreme as experienced at the heights of market volatility, they remain substantially wider than pre-crisis level. One buy-side respondent shared their analysis, suggesting that the generic bid-ask spread for European IG credit was around 10 basis points prior to the crisis, but widened to 43 basis points at its peak. This subsequently contracted, but by the end of April was still around 21 basis points, twice pre-crisis levels. Notably, secondary trading volumes in European IG corporate bonds do not appear to have reduced significantly during the crisis. And despite a small decrease in early to mid-March, they seem to have increased post-March 18. This seems consistent with participant testimonies. What the data does not capture, however, is that volumes did not keep up with orders, which increased significantly during this period. One sell-side contributor suggests that inquiries during late February and early March increased by 100 to 150%, while another, consistent with this observation, reports hit rates, that's the ratio of requested quotes provided to executed trades, dropping from a typical level of around 75% to 30 to 45%. As is often the case when it comes to measuring liquidity, it is a number of unexecuted orders that tells the full story. Aside from the perennial debate about market liquidity, perhaps the most prominent focus of discourse in recent years with respect to the European credit markets has been related to its structural evolution, and in particular, the rapid growth of venue-based trading and automation. What many studies and reports have highlighted is that despite the ever-increasing complexity and digitalization of the market infrastructure, the elemental structure of the corporate bond market remains fundamentally unchanged as a dealer-centric model that attempts to fulfill the need of otherwise scarce liquidity. The COVID-19 crisis would appear to have provided a useful opportunity to strip back the layers of technological development of the past decade to reveal its intrinsic core. A dealer-based market where market makers remain the primary source of executionable prices, and liquidity is reliant on their capacity to assume and recycle market risk. Respondents confirm that during the peak of the crisis, for the most part, electronic trading in the European corporate bond markets pretty much broke down as participants resorted to voice trading. This was not so much due to technological challenges with firms relocating from their trading floors, but rather the consequence of market conditions. Essentially, the market became too volatile and too illiquid for dealers and other liquidity providers to risk providing pricing across electronic platforms. Participants note that a significant proportion of flow in the European corporate bond markets is automated, particularly for smaller sizes and more actively traded items, with requests for quotes being automatically routed into the market via order management systems, OMS, or execution management systems, EMS, and with dealers responding to RFQs or providing price streaming by means of algorithms. This so-called low-touch activity can be as much as 60 to 70% of an asset manager's flow, leaving more time for them and their dealer counterparts to focus on the more difficult, price-sensitive, high-touch flow, involving larger sizes and less liquid bonds. As the volatility increased, it is reported that algo trading, in many cases, had to be shut off. One participant suggests that many pricing models are designed to sustain market moves of up to 5 standard deviations, in itself a pretty rare event. In the days leading up to and out of March 18, the market was experiencing moves of up to 10 standard deviations. However, one sell-side respondent argues that this was not the case for every bank, and that some were able to continue auto-quoting, albeit with much wider bid-offer spreads. They further suggest that in some respects, algos used in the European market tend to be more robust than those used in the US, since they are less reliant on actual trade data in their modeling, utilizing synthetic composite prices instead, which is largely a consequence of less immediate post-trade data. Whether feeding prices onto platforms automatically or manually, however, it would seem that this was largely with the intention of dealers encouraging clients to pick up the phone and negotiate a tighter price. Buy sides also note that any prices that could be found on platforms were unlikely to be executable, while in many cases, electronic RFQs did not return quotes. As one buy-side participant explains, everything effectively became high touch, involving direct messaging or a phone call with a salesperson. Meanwhile, to the extent that buy-sides were able to continue to rely on their OMS or EMS functionality, this required far greater flexibility in their price tolerance parameters. While overall e-trading volumes reduced dramatically relative to voice, overall volumes on venues are reported to have remained high, registering record volumes at certain points. Meanwhile, some protocols appear to have fared better than others. A number of respondents report that as it became more difficult to find the 3 or more quotes that are often required as part of a firm's best execution policy, they turn to all-to-all RFQ functionality to reach a broader base of potential liquidity providers. Similarly, anonymous trading venues, sometimes referred to as dot pools, also found traction. Additionally, it would seem as if portfolio trading, whereby dealers provide an overall price for a list of multiple bonds on an all-or-nothing basis, took on more value as working individual orders became manually too intensive. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the most utilized venue protocol during this period appears to have been move to venue, also referred to as process trades, whereby trades are negotiated over the phone or via messaging, and then once agreed, consummated through a platform in order for the parties to benefit from automated post-trade processes, such as reporting and settlement. Market makers are at the core of corporate bond secondary markets and the primary source of liquidity, whether using trading venues or not. What the COVID-19 crisis seems to have highlighted is the importance of the dealer-investor relationship, which takes on even greater significance in times of market stress. The interviews and survey responses suggest that while many banks did step up to the plate to continue providing liquidity and making markets for their clients, albeit with significantly wider bid-offer spreads, this was not the case for all market makers. And overall dealer capacity appears to have shrunk at a time when it was needed most. While it would appear that generally stricter capital rules and smaller balance sheets for market making is an important consideration in this scenario, it is reported that in some cases, dealers stepped away from their usual market making activities. Some respondents suggest that in many cases, this may have been a bank policy decision, while another theory is that some desks lacked the experience of heightened market volatility and viewed the market turbulence as a threat rather than an opportunity. As one interviewee put it, who wants to catch a falling knife? Similarly, with respect to the post-March 18 rebound, it is also reported that some, potentially inventory light, dealers shied away from showing offers for fear of being caught short. However, some participants, both sell side and buy side, point out that for those traders with the technical know-how and capacity to take risk, this was a chance to make exceptional returns, both on the way down and the way up. But when your only experience of trading markets is an environment of benign volatility and artificially compressed spreads, the moves witnessed in February and March would probably have seemed quite surreal. It is also noted that a lack of market environmental diversity probably did not help, with the loss of market participants such as bank proprietary trading desks and credit relative value hedge funds, which traditionally have provided a contrarian, more value-driven position in the face of extreme market moves, helping to create an alternative source of liquidity for market makers to access, in effect, the other side of the market, while also smoothing volatility. Participants note that moves by both the Federal Reserve and the ECB to relax capital constraints on banks' market-making services were helpful and allowed banks to expand their liquidity provision. Furthermore, the broadening of central bank purchase programs to include short-dated commercial paper also helped to free up bank balance sheets, which had come under pressure as corporates turned to their bank credit facilities to remain liquid. But the main observation of buy side seems to be the value of strong relationships with their dealer banks, and also in knowing who will be there when most needed and when the screens go blank. Settlement fails are an important consideration with respect to the recent crisis. It is noted by a number of buy side and sell side participants that there was a sizable, albeit temporary, increase in settlement fails during the height of the crisis. This is largely attributed to operational challenges related to transitioning middle and back office teams to disaster offsites and home working, as well as the impact of lockdowns on outsourced settlement teams, such as those based in India, at a time when overall trading volumes were significantly above average. As some explained, it was important, at least for a short while, to tolerate settlement fails in order for the market to continue to function. Nonetheless, it is evident that the market did take steps to contain settlement risk during this period, including Euroclear, notably opening on a weekend on March 28th, in order to process a growing backlog of settlement instructions. Both buy sides and sell sides also report issuing contractual buy-in notices in selective instances to help expedite the settlement of sticky fails, while acknowledging that successfully executing an actual buy-in would have been challenging and the settlement chain ramifications too difficult to contemplate. By early April, it would appear that settlement efficiency rates normalized. This increase in structural settlement fails has accentuated concerns about the EU CSDR mandatory buy-in provisions due to come into force in early 2021. And raises questions as to how this would have impacted the market if it had been in place during the COVID-19 turbulence. The general view of participants is that it would have turned a crisis into a catastrophe. Firstly, the time and resources required to manage the buy-in process, which requires operational trading and legal input, would have been a significant drain on already stretched staff. Secondly, trying to buy in illiquid securities in an already stressed and often chaotic market would only have exacerbated market volatility while compromising market stability. And thirdly, as previously highlighted, anything that further restricts market maker capacity would have been an additional blow to liquidity at a time when it was most needed. A number of participants expressed their hope that the regulatory community uses experience as an opportunity to reconsider and possibly recalibrate this unhelpful regulatory initiative. The COVID-19 crisis perhaps also provides a number of lessons from which market participants and other stakeholders can potentially learn, and which may help to inform future market developments related to structure, innovation, and regulation. Not least since it is safe to assume that a return to the old normal is unlikely, at least anytime soon. So here are some of the lessons potentially learned from the crisis. One, market infrastructure held up through the crisis, and both buy-side and sell-side traders were quickly and successfully able to adapt to operating remotely. The observed increase in voice trading relative to e-trading was largely a consequence of market volatility and liquidity conditions, and not because of any technological deficiencies. Two, constraints on dealer balance sheets limit the extent to which market makers can provide liquidity when markets become heavily directionally skewed, which in turn exacerbates market moves and price gapping. However, it is also observable that some dealers choose to reduce their propensity to take risk under stress conditions. Three, while central bank intervention is critical in a crisis, it is also a double-edged sword. The announcement of the ECB's PEP on March 18 effectively brought the market back from the brink, restoring confidence for both investors and liquidity providers. However, it also becomes clear that sustained central bank bond purchases result in artificial credit valuations and a mispricing of risk. Four, while the corporate bond ETF market appears to have functioned well during the crisis, sustaining heightened inflows and outflows amidst significant price volatility, there is also a view that the associated flows in the underlying baskets help to amplify moves in the bond market. Five, the loss of liquidity and depth in critical ancillary markets that help to hedge and recycle risk, in particular the single name CDS and credit repo markets, are viewed as exacerbating the crisis. Six, while the imminent EU mandatory buy-in regime is expected to reduce corporate bond market liquidity and efficiency in benign conditions, it is widely believed that this will prove to be disastrous in a stress scenario. And seven, while there are benefits to working from home, both psychological and environmental, there is also a loss of both synergy and camaraderie that the trading floor environment engenders. It may be that the future for trading will embrace a hybrid model. But perhaps the main lesson learned from the crisis is to be reminded how corporate bond secondary markets function and how liquidity is created. The structure of corporate bond markets is fundamentally different to that of the equity market. And while over a decade of technological innovation has provided significant efficiencies as well as facilitating new ways in which to access liquidity, this simple reality has not changed. Market makers remain at the core of credit markets, and it is their capacity and willingness to assume and recycle risk, both long and short, that allows the secondary market to function. This has been a central message of ICMA and the wider market for a number of years. The recognition of how bond markets function needs to be reasserted as a central consideration when designing and calibrating regulation intended to be implemented in corporate bond markets. The fact that global prudential regulation related to trading activity has been recalibrated in response to an environment of market stress would appear to support this view. Anything that constrains the ability of market makers to take prudent and appropriately priced and capitalized risk will inevitably impact market liquidity and potentially efficiency. This includes capital and liquidity rules, pre and post-trade transparency calibrations, access to ancillary hedging and financing markets, as well as the projected EU mandatory buy-in provisions. If we are to learn anything from the recent crisis, it is that whether the screens are switched on or off, it is the dealer-client relationship that ultimately holds the market together. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this ICMA podcast. For more podcasts and more information about capital markets, check out our website, icmagroup.org.